This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Iran keeps showing itself to be belligerent and defiant. Right now, it's hosting large-scale naval exercises that show just how capable it is in the waters around important Middle Eastern sea choke points. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about what Iran is accomplishing with this push and how concerning it has to be to other nations. With the Trump administration facing challenges in its relations with Russia and China, some analysts are saying, you know, why don't you go do what Henry Kissinger did in the 1970s and pit these two nations against each other? We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about how today is different from the 1970s and why that strategy won't work this time around. A lot of people don't tend to think of it this way, but you could make a strong case that Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution was far more influential philosophically than it was scientifically. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some of the philosophical ramifications of evolution. It's a really fascinating subject that will get your mental gears turning. And I'll conclude the program with a word about why you need to literally stick together with your spouse. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. This past week, Iran was conducting a large-scale naval exercise in the northern Indian Ocean. It's part of drills lasting over 2 weeks in an area of nearly 800,000 square miles from two vital choke points. On one side, you've got the Strait of Hormuz, leading into the Persian Gulf. On the other, around the Saudi Peninsula, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, leading into the Red Sea. This is an area that Iran has showed a lot of interest in recent years and really decades, but they're exercising more muscle to secure this area. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem, Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show with you today.
It's great to have you. Always appreciate it. Let's just talk about these drills. Just put this in context for us. How significant are these, and what is Iran trying to accomplish here?
I think they're quite significant. As you said, they're a continuation of the drills that took place earlier on in the month, which were mainly land-based. And we talked about that, I think maybe on this program, as being kind of a sign to Donald Trump that, if you're going to go, because there was all that rhetoric between the two sides earlier in this month, and there was a hardening position from the United States, and then they decided to start going with these large-scale drills. And now we're looking on the naval portion of that, and it's just a vast area. It's involving both amphibious ships, well, things can go on land and sea, as well as different frigates, destroyers. They've unveiled some new technology, some land-to-sea anti-ship technology, which I think is missile technology, laser-guided missile technology, which I think is very significant.
Yeah, this is actually one of the things that they're testing during these drills, these anti-ship missiles. So this is a new development for Iran.
Yeah, well, this is – I think they have had some type of weaponry, obviously, that can target ships from land. But this seems to be what this I think it's called the Delavier anti-ship missile, that it's portable, really easily portable, and operated by one man. And we've got a video in the article here of it, and it looks impressive that you can be firing from shore and 4 or 5 miles out, 6 miles out, hit a ship going passing by. Now, That weapon alone should be quite worrying to any company, international company, any oil company, or any shipping company that's moving large amounts of oil or other goods through those two straits that you talked about, the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, because with this anti-ship laser-guided missile that can be operated by one man, that they're in range of just a guy, one person now.
Yeah, I think, well, a couple of things here. One is maybe you could just help us to understand Iran's long-term strategy, because we have talked about just how important these choke points are to Iran, and this isn't the first time that they've said or done things that were aimed at demonstrating their rule over this area or their ability to create real problems for anybody who would try to facilitate the free flow of goods through those straits.
Yeah, this is something that our listeners will be well up to speed on, just because we've been noting every single moment that Iran takes another step to cementing its control over this waterway. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, back in 2011, before Muammar Gaddafi fell, he talked about how Iran would like to capitalize on that and also the rest of the Arab Spring, particularly in the region of the Dead Sea in the southern Mediterranean region, saying that Iran would love, and Bible prophecy shows, that they are going to control that region. So that's all the way from Libya, Egypt, down Sudan, Ethiopia. That's on one side of the Red Sea, and on the other side of the Red Sea, you'll have the nation of Yemen. And that was even before Yemen fell to the Houthis, the Iranian-backed Shiite militia, which took place in early 2015. So what we've seen in the past 4 or 5 years is Iran really try and control, or at least set itself up so that it can control in the future, because that's what Iran's all about. They're all about the threat of force. No one is worried necessarily at this point that Iran could take over the world, but Iran could do a lot to hurt you. And that threat alone can jeopardize whether or not businesses make decisions, whether they're going to sail through the Red Sea anymore, whether they're going to go around the long way, or whether nations in Europe wonder, well, if Iran wanted to, could they cut off our oil because of their strategic locations now with the Houthi militia in Yemen that overlooks this Bab el-Mandeb Strait, or the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, where Iran is on one side of that. So they want to control this strip, and I think it's significant that this very drill is exactly along that same area, going all the way along the bottom of Oman, from the Persian Gulf through the Indian Ocean, which touches up to Oman, then southern Yemen, and then all the way to the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. This is Iran's strategy to control those territorial waters.
You have to think that leaders in Europe and European capitals are really locked in to what's happening here and aware of every advancement that Iran makes in putting these really valuable choke points, taking them more under their control. You also have to think, and maybe we can just save this for a little bit later in the discussion, about what this means for the Trump presidency and just how Iran continues to escalate this situation and not back down at all, despite the threats that have come from the White House. But you mentioned the Houthis in Yemen, and it wasn't that long ago we were talking about this this attack on the Saudi frigate that happened earlier this year. I guess it was just a few weeks ago. So it's interesting looking at these drills that Iran is undertaking now in the context of this increase of attacks in the Red Sea, that Saudi frigate attack being probably the most spectacular of those, but really there's been quite a lot of activity in here that is in the same vein. Just to help us to understand what, how much Iran is behind this, and how much those attacks are demonstrating this a bit of a stranglehold that Iran is getting over this area.
Yeah, well, these attacks were rare. The type of attacks from Yemen's coast against shipping, be it a Saudi frigate or the USS Mason that was attacked late 2016 as well, or even the numerous just commercial ships that have been attacked by the Houthis through this area. They didn't really happen until the Houthis took over in western Yemen. There was the odd attack through this Bab el-Mandeb Strait and down into the Gulf of Aden back But they were mainly Somali pirates back in the late, 2008, 9, 10. We had a lot of pirating that was taking place there from Somalia. And that was the main worry of a lot of ships going through there. But ever since the Houthis took over in 2015, Western Yemen, we've got an increase in these specific targeted attacks on defense ships or naval ships from different nations. Now, are the Iranians allied with the Houthis? You'll hear many people that don't say that the connection is as strong as Hezbollah, the proxy that it has in Lebanon, and it probably isn't as strong as that. And yet, if you look at the numerous, I think we're up to five now, containers worth or different ships that have been caught transporting weaponry from Iran, docking in Western Yemen ports to Houthi soldiers, they've come from Iran. If you look at, I think it was about 3 months ago, there was a cache of weaponry that was tracked going the overland route through Oman into Yemen, and that is easily smuggled from Iran, landing in Oman and going the overland route that way. And then if you look at the Iranians themselves, I think it was one of their generals that talked about when the Houthis actually overtook the capital of Yemen, Sana'a, back in 2015, they said that we now hold four Middle Eastern capitals. Yeah, Tehran, obviously, and then Damascus, Beirut in Lebanon, and saying Sana'a, the Iranians said, we now hold that as our own. So the Iranians are saying it, that they are backing these the Houthis that are jeopardizing trade here or shipping movements through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait.
Well, it seems like the chaos, the uncertainty that the Houthis are creating down there certainly works in Iran's favor. And you can see why they would be supporting that activity, and it's causing a lot of consternation in Saudi Arabia and in other capitals in the area and in Europe as well. I'd like to just take a quick diversion, talk a little bit about the Iranian election. Maybe you could just catch us up to speed. This is this coming May 19th. How is this election in Iran shaping up?
So this would be the re-election of more of the moderate type, Rouhani, the reformist. At least that's the way that they're labeled in Iran. There's reformist, and then there is the conservative or the hardliners, as we would call them in the West. And every president in Iran since the Islamist takeover in 1979 has served two terms, his two allotted terms, except they are up for re-election after 4 years. And we are looking at a situation where this coming May 19th, Rouhani might become the very first president to only serve one term because of a number of factors. And I think one of the articles was last week in The Trumpet by Callum Wood about this, he'd said that we are going to have a hardliner that's probably elected this coming May because of this election is largely a referendum on the nuclear deal from Iran's standpoint. And Rouhani was the face of the nuclear deal. He was the one that snuggled up to the West, at least from Iranian people, their perspective. And he said, well, we're in a bad way with the United States, both financially and the threat of military action is there, apparently. This is what brought him, strengthen his position on power. And he pushed hard for the nuclear deal. And yet what we've seen right now is the threat of war with the United States looks stronger than ever. And the material benefits, economic benefits for the people in Iran that Rouhani promised them under the nuclear deal haven't materialized. So if, the United States over the next coming months before the election does increase the rhetoric and make the threat of war look even more possible, that is not going to suit Rouhani as well. And the Iranian public will call for a stronger, more confrontational leader to guide them through the Donald Trump era.
So just a whole lot of factors here that are all kind of playing to steer this situation in a more dangerous direction. And I'd like to just finish by putting this in the context of the Trump presidency and the rhetoric that's been exchanged. It seems like it's been a little quieter in the last week or so. For a while there, it would almost look like we were right on the on the brink of going to war. What's the situation now, and how much? It seems like Iran really is. If you've got the public that are saying, "Look, we can't kowtow to the Trump administration," they don't seem at all interested in backing away from their stance. And these drills that we were talking about, it all seems to feed into this narrative that they're going to keep pressing forward and pushing.
Yeah, so we don't really know whether Mr. Trump is going to attack Iran. The rhetoric seemed as though that he was going to at least increase sanctions or put sanctions back on Iran, financial sanctions, and that's what he's done. But when you have – I don't want to belittle the Iranian elections, but they are really a sideshow to the bigger point, and that is Iran is led by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, more than anybody else, more than the president that gets in power. He is the man, and he has based his – since 1989, I believe, when he came into office, he has based a lot of his position and of power in Iran on the fact that he is anti-America. I'm going to stand up to America. They're not big enough. They're not bigger than us. We have a strong military. We can take them. So he's got his whole 16, 17 years in power based on that. And so I don't think the Iranians are going to back down, and the public will likely call for a strong, at least vocal figure in the presidential office to really align Iran together with the rest of Iran, together with what the Ayatollah wants.
Interesting stuff. We got to keep our eyes on this this region for sure. We appreciate how you're focusing our attention on that, putting articles up on the Trumpet site. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Iran and recent large-scale naval exercises, as well as upcoming presidential elections there. He's got an article up right now at thetrumpet.com called "Iranian Navy Conducts Expansive Drills in Vital Sea Lane." And we also have an article last week, I think, from Callum Wood about Iran's next president. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Brent, keep watching. Thanks.
No problem. It's a pleasure.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Trump administration is facing some very difficult challenges internationally. And right near the top of that list, you have to look at the threats that are posed by both Russia and China. With Russia, you have an aggressive country making incursions into Eastern Europe, led by a strong man. In China, you have it moving into the South China Sea, undertaking efforts to overturn the global economic order. Both of these nations engaging in cyber attacks against the United States. And some analysts are saying, well, Mr. Trump, if you want to deal with both of these problems, you can follow a model that was the diplomacy exercised by Henry Kissinger in the 1970s. That would be one way to handle this well. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques says that's not going to work. And we're going to talk to him about this. He's here in the studio with us. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So start by telling us about Kissinger's diplomatic efforts with these two nations and why they were relatively successful.
Sure. Yeah, at the time that Kissinger came onto the scene, the assistant to Nixon there, Russia and China were both communist powers. However, they had some deeply rooted ideological differences between them. Both of them were in pursuit of what you might call the one true communism. The two were in fierce competition with each other about which one would become sort of the leader of the communist world. And so what Kissinger was able to do is sort of exploit that competition, exploit those divisions. And eventually he was able to kind of spearhead an opening up of China to America, which ended up placing America closer to both China and the Soviet Union than either of them were to each other. So they call it triangular diplomacy, and it really was just a pretty remarkable development that happened there. And so now, you know, you've got a lot of analysts saying, Mr. Trump, let's try this triangular diplomacy. Let's try to do something like that again. And of course, there has been a lot of mutual respect between Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin. Mr. Trump has made clear that he would like to improve the relationship between the U.S. and Russia that has become so strained in recent years. But at the Trumpet, we've always said that Mr. Trump's efforts in this area will not be enough, and that the Russia-China cooperation will only end up growing stronger. And there's a really powerful analysis published in The Diplomat this week that basically just affirms what we've said about that with very compelling logic. It basically just says the conditions now are not what they were in the late 60s and early 70s when Kissinger was on the scene.
Well, the relationship between Russia and China, so during the 1970s when Kissinger was there and he was exploiting the differences between these two nations, you look at them today and there's a lot of collusion between them, a lot of trade relations, energy deals, and that type of thing. And I'm just realizing as we're talking about this how recent that development really is.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the Soviet Union and China, they had some pretty serious border wars in the 60s. Heavy skirmishes erupted throughout the whole decade. They did, of course, have communism in common, but because they were both in pursuit of, you know, the different brands of it. You had Mao Zedong there in China, and then Nikita Khrushchev. Those two especially hated each other just because of that competition for which would become sort of that leader of communism. But today, though, especially since 2014, back in 2014, of course, that's when Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula, sent its military into eastern parts of the country. And at that time, the U.S. and a lot of its Western partners levied heavy sanctions on Russia as punishment for that. And those sanctions ended up driving Russia toward greater cooperation with China. You know, Vladimir Putin and others in the Russian leadership kind of said, well, if the West is isolating us and punishing us, we'll look east. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote a powerful article around that time. It's called Asia Stands with Putin. And this article basically just shows that even though the Obama administration was trying to isolate Russia, there were at least 3 billion people in Asia, mostly in China and also in India, who were all too eager to welcome Russia instead of going along with those Western sanctions and efforts at isolation. So here we are about 3 years on from that article, and the Russia-China relationship remains very strong. And the main difference now between the situation that Kissinger and Nixon were looking at and the present day is just that now the ideological differences that Russia and China have between them are trumped by their shared animosity toward the United States and toward the West.
Right. You could really see how much that's driving policy in both Moscow and Beijing. Both of these countries that have really been making strong effort to undermine America's leadership in the world. And that one thing, and you're talking about, say, sanctions against Russia that have driven Russia more towards seeking a stronger alliance with China. In some ways, you can say China is experiencing a similar drive toward into the arms of Russia based on forces within the world today. These two have a whole lot to benefit from an alliance, and they're taking advantage of that.
That's exactly right. I'd like to read a short quote from this Diplomat article that really explains it. It says, both countries, both Russia and China, harbor intense authoritarian nationalist opposition to Western and globalist ideologies. Putin and China's ruling Communist Party have similar views of the threat posed by Western universal values such as democracy and human rights. They see foreign influence, which they believe have penetrated their societies through globalization, the internet, social media, and NGOs, as the primary threat to their domestic grip on power. For China and Russian governing elites, these influences are a Trojan horse designed to spark destabilizing color revolutions that produce regime change in non-Western or authoritarian political systems. And from there, the article goes on to explain that both Russia and China have seen those kinds of revolutions right on their doorsteps. For Russia, it was the 2013-2014 Maidan protests there in Ukraine. And then with China, it was Hong Kong's 2014 Umbrella Revolution. So both Putin and China's Xi Jinping see these kinds of attempts at revolution as existential threats, you know, threats that are posed to their grip on power.
Caused by the West.
Exactly. They blame it entirely on the West. They blame America. They say these things are evidence that America is subverting their political systems and their domestic legitimacy as well. So the shared hatred that Russia and China have for America trumps any of the ideological differences that they may have with each other. And it really welds modern Russia and China together powerfully.
So it seems really what we're looking at here is kind of the logic behind something that we have talked about quite a lot in terms of what's prophesied in the end time in the Bible, biblical prophecies that demonstrate this alliance occurring between Russia and China, the two powerhouses in Asia that will have a lot of other smaller Asian nations rally behind them. But this is really kind of the two pillars of this Asian alliance that's prophesied in the Bible. When you look at it historically, we were talking about the 60s and 70s and the animosity between them. Really, what we're seeing today is a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy in and of itself. But you're talking about, say, what's driving these two together, and you can kind of see how this is all coming about according to what the Bible said would happen.
That's true. And one especially remarkable thing about those prophecies of Russia-China, you know, cooperation is that Herbert W. Armstrong, who wrote extensively about that, he was able to, well, he prophesied based on what was written in the Bible that Russia and China would form this bloc that we see now. But he wrote that at that time when they hated each other so much. It would have been very difficult to see during the 60s and 70s that what Mr. Armstrong had written would you know, come to pass. But here we are, though, and it's very evident. Everyone in the world can now see this great Russo-Chinese axis. So I just find it remarkable that he was able to make that prophecy really when there was so little evidence of it to be seen at that time.
We have a chapter in the booklet, He Was Right, on that very subject, don't we?
We do, yes. He just really highlighting exactly what Mr. Armstrong said, which specific Bible prophecies he based those statements on, and then also just really highlighting how much faith it would have taken, in a sense, to believe that at a time when evidence of it was so scant.
Yeah. Well, listeners can write us at letters@thetrumpet.com or go online to thetrumpet.com and look for that booklet, He Was Right, under the Literature tab. It's one chapter of several there that show Herbert W. Armstrong's success in prophesying some of these major world trends that we've seen coming to pass since his death in 1986. This Russia-China axis is really a powerful vindication of what he was saying decades ago. Another amazing resource is the Russia and China in Prophecy booklet. We've beefed that up over the last year. Jeremiah, you've put a lot of work into to making that a really powerful resource to explain several of the prophecies. What are the passages that we're looking at in order to make these predictions and prophecies about what's happening today?
Yes, I think both of those are very powerful resources. He Was Right and Russia and China and Prophecy, if you'd like to understand what's happening there. And then also Mr. Fleury's article written in 2014, Asia Stands with Putin. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. And Mr. Fleury was able to see back in 2014 that the Russia-China partnership wasn't something that was going to be easily broken by, you know, say, a change in the U.S. administration, the way a lot of onlookers researchers now think it could be. And time has really proven the accuracy of that article as well, which this new diplomat analysis shows.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about America's challenges with Russia and China and this amazing alliance that has developed between these two Asian giants. He's working all this together in a little article on the subject with links to everything, all of the relevant material that we've been discussing. You can watch for that in the coming days online at thetrumpet.com. Jeremiah, we appreciate your time.
Appreciate you having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
There's a lot of concern about nuclear proliferation in the world today, obviously a very deadly threat in our world. But are nuclear weapons the most dangerous weapon that exists today? Herbert W. Armstrong actually made a really provocative claim in 1969. He wrote an article in The Plain Truth, October 1969, and he said this: the forces of Antichrist are organized. The war is on, not a war of flesh and blood, of firearms and armies and navies, but a subtle, insidious war on our children's minds. Better 1,000 times to have our children's bodies slain in a physical war than have their minds destroyed in this intellectual war of Satan. Then he said this: I repeat that evolution is Satan's most powerful modern weapon. It is Christianity's greatest enemy. Really interesting point there. And trumpet writer Andrew Miller has been giving this some thought. We're going to talk about some evidence to support that statement. I mean, this is a pretty provocative, provocative statement. Evolution more dangerous than nuclear weapons. But that's what we're going to talk about. So, hello, Andrew. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So, when Darwin first unleashed this idea and tried to give scientific credibility to the idea that everything just came about on its own, that it was not created, but that it just materialized through evolutionary forces, he was kind of following a certain intellectual train of thought without necessarily contemplating the social ramifications and the kind of implications that this would have for society more broadly and for many of the ideas that had underpinned human civilization for thousands of years. But in reality, he kind of ended up being, you could make a strong case that he was the most influential philosopher of modern day by unleashing this idea.
Definitely, you can make a very strong case that he would have been the most influential philosopher, at least of the last 500 years, even though at the beginning of his career, he just considered himself a simple naturalist. The idea of evolution, that mankind evolved from inanimate matter, is very ancient. Even Aristotle had talked some of about this, but they really had no... it never really caught on as a big thing because there's really no like scientific proof or even nominal scientific proof to back this up until when Darwin started studying like these finches and the Galapagos Islands and different butterflies and how beak shapes change. I mean, he started to see naturally how characteristics in animals can change. And then in his Origin of Species, even though he didn't have evidence as to what the limits of this change were, he started to speculate and postulate that this might be almost like an infinite amount of change, that you could actually, using the same methods that changes a finch's beak shape, could actually turn an amoeba to a human being, giving enough time.
So he published Origin of Species in what year?
It would have been published in 1854, although he'd been working on it for a couple decades before that.
Okay, so middle of the 19th century, and several decades go by, this takes on more and more cachet in the intellectual world, in the academic world. More and more people buy into this idea. But let's just talk about some of the implications of the idea that all of this came from nothing, essentially, and describe, you know, look into and talk about why this is such a catastrophic force that has been unleashed in our world. What are some of the basic conclusions that you end up drawing once you've accepted that premise?
Right. Well, even Darwin himself, after he published this, had gone from like an Anglican Christian in his youth to an agnostic around the time he published Origin of Species to being pretty much a hardcore atheist by the end of his life. And many of his disciples and people who read his books took the same standpoint, that are like, well, if we have a scientific theory that we think can explain creation without a creator, this is going to really just lead to the belief, which has caught hold amongst millions and millions of people around the world now, that there is no God. That's probably the first great or the first influential societal change from a philosophical standpoint that evolution made, is it led at least a veneer of scientific credibility to the belief that there is no God. We all evolved from inanimate organic matter.
So once you've accepted that premise, that's a pretty dramatic change. That has other ramifications. What are some of those?
Right. You keep going as like, okay, so you're thinking, you know, at first that sounds okay. Well, maybe that doesn't sound so bad. If you want to, you can believe in God if you want to. You cannot believe in God if you want to. But you also, from a standpoint that is like, from like a Christianity standpoint, our morality comes from God. Or even you agree to something like the Declaration of Independence, where it says we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men were created equal and are endowed by their creator with an inalienable to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. If you assume that there is no creator, there is no inalienable right to anything, mm-hmm. not life, not liberty, not pursuit of happiness, not morality. Morality is just the result of circumstances and evolution. And even Darwin, who as a 20-year-old Anglican seminary student wouldn't have believed this, but by the time he got to middle age or even elderly age and started writing one of his other books, Descent of Man, even said that in as many words, that morality is a byproduct of evolution, even comparing human beings to like bees, to where they say like bees, the females kick the males out in the winter to freeze to death. Because they have no social function in the winter. Their social function is to fertilize the queen. That happens in the summer. The wintertime, they're just an extra mouth to feed. And Darwin argues like that's a moral decision for bees, because it's in their circumstance, it's for the good of the colony. And then makes the same point that he says, if man is nothing more than an animal and there is no God, then like bees, our morality changes as we evolve and as our circumstances change.
And that led him to some pretty horrific conclusions by the end of his life. Once he starts going down that path, where does he end up?
Right. Well, there are two, even though almost anyone who studies evolution in college has to read Origin of Species, the book he wrote when he was younger, they commonly cover up the Descent of Man. That's not nearly as widely read, because it's almost on par with like Mein Kampf and the Communist Manifesto as to just how vile a book it is, where this reasoning of logic, like there is no God, led Darwin by the end of his life. I've actually got two really powerful quotes from that Descent of Man I can bring here today. But the first one earlier on in the book, he says, with savages, the weak in body and mind are soon eliminated, and those that survive commonly exhibit a vigorous state of health. We civilized men, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the process of elimination. We build asylums for the imbeciles, the maimed, and the sick. We institute poor laws or welfare laws. And our medical men exert the utmost skill to save the life of even one of the in the last moments. there's reason to believe that vaccination has preserved thousands who, from a weakened constitution, would formerly have succumbed to smallpox. Thus, the weak members of civilized society propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man.
Hmm. So he would have them, he would have the weak die out because the basically the governing principle of morality is survival of the fittest.
Survival of the fittest. So it's there. And I guess that even that second quote takes that first quote to a second, to its next step, where he, this is a prediction Darwin has made. He said, at some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace throughout the world the savage races. At the same time, the anthropomorphous apes will no doubt be exterminated. The break will be rendered wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, as we may hope, than the Caucasian, and some ape as low as the baboon, instead of at present between the Negro, the Australian, and the gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
So this is...
So he's looking at blacks as a less evolved version.
Yeah, that's basically his descent of man, as he's saying that, okay, the baboons evolved into the savage races, the blacks, the Australians from, or the Aborigines from Australia, and the gorillas, which then evolved into the higher, more civilized races, as Darwin would put it, like the Caucasian race. And he's saying that just with survival of the fittest, that like in the animal world, he's saying that, well, if these are lower races, then their genes have to be expunged from the gene pool if evolution is to continue and mankind's to get better and better.
Now, there's a lot of people that criticize, say, Bible believers for having racist views. When you look at, say, the idea behind the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. It was actually a religious belief in the supremacy of a creator who created all men, and the Bible talks about him creating of one blood men of all nations, all races. But we hear a whole lot less about the racist ideas inherent within an evolutionary view. That tends to be...
That is true. There, I mean, obviously the founding fathers believed all men were created equal and endowed with their creator with certain unalienable rights. There were other preachers in America who twisted the scriptures to try to make it seem like some races were inferior than others. And we definitely hear a lot about those people today. But they just really gloss over the fact that especially after the Civil War was over, during like the Progressive Era, the Jim Crow South, all this type, there's a lot of that ideology was based on like a social Darwinist
right.
philosophy.
But to get back to the larger point, if you view, say, fellow man of whatever race as a child of God and one to whom you need to offer respect and deference because he's a fellow human being who God made in his image, you're going to treat that person very differently than if you live in a world where basically he's just an inferior version of yourself and, you know, destined to die out because of genetic deformity or that type of thing. But we're talking about more of the ramifications that come from this idea. Once you've divorced the idea of a God who created everything and who is the originator not only of material creation, but also morality, defining good and evil and so on, you're really kind of unmoored from the things that have really anchored and tethered society and civilization for millennia. What's another, outcome of that line of reasoning?
Right. Well, the other also is kind of what you said, the same thing, is that if you believe that your rights come from your creator and they're inalienable, no one can take them away from you. If there is no creator and the rights are no inalienable and there is no universal absolute truth concept of right and wrong, your rights come from the society you live in or the state. And so in a lot of ways, the state becomes God in the fact that you're not getting your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness from your creator, because there is no creator, if evolution's true. You're getting your rights from the state. And that way, if you cross the state like God, the state has the right to extinguish your life. It's like I said, rain down smite upon the wicked. This was it said that Karl Marx wanted to dedicate the Communist Manifesto to Darwin, and Darwin wasn't quite comfortable with him doing that. But it still shows that how much the Darwinist philosophy had on communist philosophy as well. That they figure there is no God, there is no right or wrong, except what human minds devise. Therefore, whatever government our human minds devise is, in effect, the new God.
Mm-hmm.
I've got another quote here. This is from Whitaker Chambers, a very famous communist defector in the 1940s, where he said, "Hence, the Communist Party is quite justified in calling itself the most revolutionary party in history. It has posed in practical form the most revolutionary question in history, God or man. It has taken the next logical step which 300 years of rationalism hesitated to take and said what millions of modern minds think but do not dare or care to say. If man's mind is the decisive force in the world, what need is there for God?" It's saying that you just really bring out that, I mean, people talk like, well, communism, obviously most people agree, like Stalinist Russia took a bad turn. But Whitaker Chambers will argue that it's like, no, this is really the only way it could have ended, when you accept Darwin's original hypothesis that evolution's true. There is no God. There is no such thing as right and wrong. Your rights come from the state, and the state giveth and the state taketh away.
Right. Yeah, that Whitaker Chambers essay is phenomenally powerful and really does show just how dangerous the line of reasoning is. In a sense, the individual who accepts the idea that all of this came about through natural forces without any reason, without any purpose, is kind of staring out into a cold, black, meaningless universe. But the communist basically says, no, don't worry. We have the promise of something better. There is meaning in it, and it's something that human beings have come up with. Human mind is at the center of the universe, and we're going to be able to extend this utopian vision across the world. It gives that individual who has no hope some level of hope, a very false hope, a very counterfeit hope. But you can see the appeal. I think that Whitaker Chambers essay shows how so many people got wrapped up into that way of thinking in the godless world that was created from Darwinism and its antecedents. Well, we've been talking with Andrew Miller about evolution and some of the philosophical ramifications of the evolutionary way of thinking. So he's at this point not necessarily going to write an article about it. But what do you think, listeners? Should he write this up as an article? It's an interesting subject with a lot of thought-provoking ramifications to it. But you let us know what you think by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
The English word cleave is quirky. Webster's defines it to adhere firmly or closely, or loyally and unwaveringly. but it also defines it exactly the opposite, to divide by, or as if by a cutting blow. So one of the first biblical commands regarding marriage is found in Genesis 2 and verse 24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. A husband and wife must cleave, in the first sense, that is, because if we don't, then in effect we cleave our marriages in the opposite way. What does God mean when he tells us to cleave? The Hebrew word means to cling or adhere, to catch by pursuit. Elsewhere in the Bible, the same word is translated abide fast, follow close, be joined, pursue hard, and stick. In the midst of life's hubbub, actively cleaving to your spouse in love doesn't happen accidentally. So many concerns can compete for your attention. Children, work, friends, church, chores, errands, bills, diversions, not to mention your relationship with God. How often, at the end of the day, do you crash the moment your head hits the pillow and neglect spending time cleaving to your spouse? Not just physically, but spiritually, mentally, emotionally. It doesn't take much neglect to go from cleaving to merely coexisting. One flesh is what God wants in marriage. Oneness in sharing your thoughts, attitudes, emotions, bodies, and the physical things in life. After the workday, outside responsibilities and interests can continue to pull you away from each other if you're not careful. Television or other entertainment typically shuts down communication and can end up being a crutch that gives an illusion of togetherness, but actually cleaves your marriage in the wrong way. Husbands, is your heart at home with your wife? Your heart, is that where your primary interest lies? The answer to that question can help you determine how well you are cleaving to her. Remaining truly faithful to your wife requires deep mental, emotional, and psychological attachment. Spend time cleaving. Share your life. Read together. Listen to music together. Take walks together. Talk together. Do things together. Study the Bible together. Rekindle the flames of romance that drew you together. Court each other. Get a babysitter for your children and go out for a date, and not too infrequently. With planning and effort, you may even be able to take short trips alone, 2 to 3 days long, 2 to 3 times a year. How is your communication? A couple should have more to talk about together the longer their marriage lasts. If you're making a vigorous effort to cleave, then your common interests and your ability to relate will grow with time. You'll feel close emotionally, and your shared understanding, your affection, will make your marriage a joy. Sadly, for many marriages, a mountain of mutual effort is required to restore the relationship to a truly healthy state. If the idea of cleaving in the way that I'm talking about seems overwhelming, that's a good indication you and your mate would benefit from some marital counseling. A happy marriage is not only one of life's greatest blessings, it does much to help us overcome our selfishness and to learn the great joy of living the give way of life. Investing abundantly in your marriage isn't just a nice way to pass the time. So become a cleaver. Practice the art of cleaving in the right sense. Cleave to your mate. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests today. We had Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Baldwin. Fires cannot be made with dead embers. nor can enthusiasm be stirred by spiritless men. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.